This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon, and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, an institution dedicated to serving adult students by bringing a progressive perspective to educating the whole person. Listeners can learn about 23 bachelor's degree programs in the arts, business, and helping professions at the information session on Saturday, August 24th at 9 a.m. Details at merrillhurst.edu.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, U.S. Representative Peter DeFazio has introduced a bill that would increase logging in some Oregon county-owned lands.
A new study finds that single-payer health care will save the country $500 billion in its first year.
And Oregon State University will create its own independent governing board, joining Portland State University and the University of Oregon.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. It's been 2 years since Portland officially banned single-use plastic bags from local stores and restaurants. Now, a statewide environmental advocacy organization is leading the charge to expand the ban to surrounding cities. On Tuesday, Environment Oregon hit the pavement in Tigard, Lake Oswego, and Beaverton to spread the word about its latest efforts. Members of the organization dropped thousands of petitions at the doorsteps of city councils in each of these three cities. Also on hand was the Bag Monster, a man dressed in a costume made up of 500 single-use plastic bags. The costume represents the average number of plastic bags a human uses in 1 year. Altogether, Oregonians use more than 1.7 billion single-use plastic bags each year, according to Environment Oregon. Millions of tons of plastic and trash dumped into the Pacific over the decades have led to the formation of a large toxic stew of plastic garbage known as the Pacific Garbage Patch. The Pacific Garbage Patch is expected to double in size within the next 10 years. A previous effort on the part of Environment Oregon to enact a statewide plastic ban failed 2 years ago. Environment Oregon could try again for statewide ban as soon as 2015. In the meantime, the organization plans to redouble its efforts to enact change at the city level. So far, Portland, Corvallis, and Eugene have adopted citywide single-use bans. Efforts to ban the bags are also gaining traction in other Oregon cities such as Bend and Ashland.
U.S. Representative Peter DeFazio from Springfield, Oregon, has a bill entering the House Committee on Natural Resources today. His Timber Trust bill would increase logging on Oregon O and C lands in order to increase revenue in rural counties. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Casey Decker has more.
Legislation by Representative Peter DeFazio that allows a lot more logging on Oregon's O&C lands gets a closer look today in the House Natural Resources Committee. It's part of a bigger package of bills that proponents say would give steady income to rural counties, and opponents say would dismantle the public land management system that balances multiple uses. Sean Stevens, executive director of Oregon Wild, describes DeFazio's bill, and one from Representative Doc Hastings of Washington, as throwbacks to the 1980s, when timber harvest was a primary goal on public land.
We know that public lands are valuable for all sorts of things, from clean water to recreation. Climate mitigation is becoming more and more of an issue. Resource extraction can play a role, but at the scale that Representative Hastings and Representative DeFazio are looking at, it just doesn't make sense for the future of Oregon's economy.
DeFazio says his bill includes some permanent protection for old-growth forests and designates some new wilderness while giving counties more timber revenue from the public land within their boundaries. His proposal takes about half of the 2.4 million acres of ONC land in Oregon and turns it into a timber trust that could be logged without having to consider at least some federal environmental laws. Stevens says that ignores science and public opinion. He says some rural counties are adapting to life without the boom and bust cycles of logging, but others continue to complain.
We're getting a little bit tired of hearing the federal government has somehow betrayed them, despite the massive subsidies that they've handed out, and despite the fact that public lands in their backyard have been nothing but an economic boon for them, not just through resource extraction, but through recreation and tourism.
DeFazio's draft legislation was introduced more than a year ago, and this is its first committee markup. No matter what happens in the committee, it faces a tough time in the U.S. Senate, partly because of the other bills in the package. For KBOO News, in association with the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
Oregon State University will follow Portland State University and the University of Oregon in creating its own independent governing board. OSU President Ed Ray was initially skeptical of the move, but after the state's other two large universities did so, he wanted to follow suit. PSU and U of O wanted another governance option aside from the statewide Board of Higher Education because they felt it would boost their fundraising. When it became clear that the state legislature was going to grant their wishes, Ray felt compelled to change as well, despite his claim that OSU had done well at fundraising without its own board. Ray said his university has offices in every county in Oregon and is committed to maintaining its statewide commitment. Each major university board will have the authority to hire and fire presidents, set tuition and fees, and oversee university operations. Governor John Kitzhaber will nominate between 11 and 15 board members for each of the large universities next month for confirmation in the Senate in September. The smaller regional universities and the Oregon Institute of Technology will be given the option to create their own governing boards later.
Milwaukee Mayor Jeremy Ferguson will run against Clackamas County Commissioner Jim Bernard for a seat on the Board of Commissioners next year. Ferguson will leave his job with Portland Streetcar on August 9th to run his campaign. Ferguson was appointed interim mayor in 2009 after Bernard resigned to join the county board. He was elected mayor in a May 2009 special election and re-elected in 2010. He said he hopes to end the board's division and, quote, do a good job at bringing some moderation, end quote. He told the Oregonian that he'd like to see the county's rural areas better represented. Ferguson worked at TriMet for more than 10 years before he worked for Portland Streetcar. As mayor, he did not participate in discussions or decisions related to light rail.
The Portland Fire and Rescue Bureau yesterday issued layoff notices to 26 workers, as mandated by the new city budget that aims to reduce the deficit. Thanks to about $500,000 in reserve funding, the layoffs will not take effect until October 9th. That gives the city time to apply for federal grant money that could help avoid these layoffs. The city has until August 30th to apply for the federal SAFER grant, but Portland Mayor Charlie Hales said that he won't seek the grant until the city understands what requirements are tied to it. The president of the local firefighters union called the mayor's statement surprising, saying the grant does not have any strings attached. The nearly 5% cut in spending will also cut the fire bureau's diving team, three fire investigators, and a safety chief.
Former Bank of Oswego executive Jeffrey S. Walsh was arraigned yesterday in federal court on charges that he defrauded an investor of $200,000. Walsh reportedly borrowed $500,000 from an unidentified Beaverton businessman last year after Bank of Oswego fired him for financial misconduct. Walsh repaid $300,000 back in June after the investor contacted the authorities. The former banker misrepresented his financial condition and sold one of the condos without telling the investor, while failing to disclose he would use the loan he received for his personal expenses. He stands charged with 5 counts of wire fraud, 2 counts of engaging in monetary transactions with criminally derived property, and 1 count of making a false statement on a loan application, Walsh pleaded not guilty and was released until his trial, October 1st.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, most likely, followed by Occupy Radio at 6, with a visit from Hayseed of the City Hall Vigil to end the camping ban. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be partly cloudy, with most of the clouds dissipating by late morning and high temperatures around 76 degrees.
It's 5:10, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Al Capone was a bad boy. How bad? He cheated on his income tax. They sent him to prison for that. Not for the people he gunned down, nor for any of the other gross illegalities he committed as a Chicago mobster. It was tax evasion that got Capone. Now comes Steve Cohen, who's not known to have killed anyone and is not a mobster, though Capone didn't think he was one either. He called himself a businessman. Yet Cohen, a multi-billionaire Wall Street hedge fund huckster, shares with Capone the unpleasant experience of being pursued by the law and possibly getting nailed on the Wall Street equivalent of tax evasion. Cohen's hedge fund, SAC Capital, was caught pocketing a gabillion or so in profit through the criminal enterprise of insider trading. But Steve was able to dodge the charges in the usual Wall Street way, by buying off the government. SAC paid about $600 million to the Securities and Exchange Commission to make the problem go away without having to admit guilt or be bothered by a trial. Neat. Yeah, a $600 million fine would be a death sentence for you and me, but it's barely a hiccup for Cohen and Company. They typically pull in about $1 billion a year just in management fees, not counting profits on investments. So Steve skated, or so he thought. It turns out that the new head of the SEC, Mary Jo White, is not a pushover for hotshot finaglers, so Cohen suddenly finds himself facing a personal administrative charge— failure to supervise his hedge fund traders. That might seem minor, but like Capone's tax evasion, it could be very major, for the punishment is to be barred from conducting Wall Street business. This is Jim Hightower saying, see, when regulators have the will, there really are ways to go after Wall Street's lawlessness.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Single-payer health care, also known as Medicare for All, could save the country over $500 billion in its first year, according to a study issued by an economist at the University of Massachusetts. The study was funded by Physicians for a National Health Program. The organization's director of policy and programs spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about a battle for universal coverage a decade in the making.
I'm talking with Dr. Ida Hellander. She is Director of Policy and Programs at the Physicians for a National Health Plan. For listeners unfamiliar with the history of H.R. 676, can you explain when it was originally introduced and how it's found its way back to the table of discussion time and time again?
Its subtitle is the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. It's been introduced continuously now for 11 years.
How comparable to the original version is the current bill?
It's changed a little over the years, mostly to tighten up the cost containment. The idea of the bill is that the vast majority of the new money needed to cover all the uninsured and to make Medicare better comes from reducing overhead in the private insurance industry and all the waste that that imposes on doctors' offices and hospitals. There's also some savings from reducing the prices of drugs, which are much more costly in the U.S. for the exact same drug than they are in other countries. So that's where most of the savings comes from that covers all, you know, can be used to cover everybody. But it's also very important to be able to keep healthcare inflation down over time. And that's where the bill changed. We put in some additional language about prohibiting for-profit, investor-owned healthcare providers from participating in the system, because there's good evidence now that they raise costs and lower the quality of care.
The report by an economics professor suggesting that if enacted, H.R. 676 can save as much as $592 billion in its first year.
While that seems like a big number, let me tell you where it comes from. Next year, we're going to spend about $3 trillion in this country on health care, and one-third of that, or $1 trillion of it, is just overhead administrative costs, you know, the cost of computers in one office that don't talk to the computers in another office, the claims, the billing, the processing, the marketing, the new health exchanges, the 25% of every hospital bill that just goes to figuring out who had what aspirin and who had which Band-Aid and then sending them an itemized bill. With one-third of every healthcare dollar currently wasted overhead in administration, that accounts for slashing that with a single-payer system and getting rid of all the different private insurance companies and just having one single system that everybody's in. That by itself would save $476 billion.
Are you expecting organized opposition to this legislation? And if so, from who? And have you any idea what arguments will be made against it?
Well, yes, there is organized opposition. The insurance industry and the pharmaceutical companies are the opposition to national health care, and they spend over $1 million per day lobbying our Congress.
What can you tell me about the professor and the study itself? Who funded it, and how long did it take to produce?
Physicians for National Health Program funded it, and what we asked Dr. Friedman was, you know, we have this bill, H.R. 676, which is our proposal for health care reform. Tell us, how much will it cost to fund it, and how can it be financed? Because these are questions we get asked all the time, so we need to know the answers to them. Professor Friedman is an economist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and he had done some work on this issue at the state level. So we asked him to look at it for us at the national level. And so he did, and he actually has been working on this study on and off for about 2 years.
Now, for folks listening to the conversation that we're having and they want to learn more and see how they can get involved and assist, where should they go? What should they look at?
Well, of course, there's the website of Physicians for a National Health Program, which is pnhp.org. But there's also a website that's very user-friendly for non-physicians. It's called healthcarenow.org.
That's healthcarenow.org. I've been talking with Ida Hellander, Director of Policy and Programs at Physicians for a National Health Program. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
The Obama administration has released a handful of formerly classified documents that shed new light on surveillance programs, particularly on the scope of phone monitoring efforts. These documents outline details of the NSA's ongoing citizen surveillance program, which aims to root out terrorists by using dragnet surveillance tactics. British newspaper The Guardian has also released the latest in a string of NSA documents leaked by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden. One of the documents published by The Guardian today is a classified presentation outlining the X-KeyScore program, which monitors citizen internet activity. The Internet Browsing Surveillance Program pulls information from about 150 network sites across the globe, according to the document. X-KeyScore monitors everything from chats to web browsing to keyword searches, looking for what the document refers to as, quote, suspicious stuff, end quote. Although the program appears to focus on monitoring communications linked to suspects, the document also indicates that a large amount of the information is drawn from random site traffic. Additional documents released by the government at the start of a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the subject describe details of the NSA's domestic phone monitoring program and define parameters for how the information gathered may be used. According to one of the documents, phone companies are only required to turn over records if an executive branch official confirms the presence of, quote, facts giving rise to a reasonable, articulable suspicion, end quote, that the number is connected to terrorism activities. The documents describe the surveillance efforts as an early warning system for the government to detect connections between potential terrorists. The documents indicate that just a fraction of the records collected are viewed by intelligence analysts. During the Judiciary Committee hearing following the release of the documents, Chairman Patrick J. Leahy, a Vermont Democrat, said he was unconvinced of the program's necessity. Leahy said, quote, "If this program is not effective, it has to end. So far, I'm not convinced by what I've seen," end quote.
Several drug rehab facilities in California have been committing fraud for years, according to a report published today. The report came out of a year-long investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting and CNN. Under California's Medicaid program, called Medi-Cal, drug and alcohol rehab centers are reimbursed with public funds for each client that they see. The investigation found that several clinics lied about client numbers, paid and bribed people to take counseling sessions, and forged therapy records and meeting notes, all to receive a large government payout. Some of these fraudulent clinics were run by convicted felons, despite laws barring felons from running Medi-Cal clinics. At least two men who have already been convicted of fraud-related crimes opened clinics in California and continued scamming the system there. They are reported to have received millions of dollars in taxpayer money. The CIR-CNN report found that government oversight was poorly organized and ineffective. While suspicions triggered some investigations, the investigations were slow and their findings did not result in action even after incriminating evidence had been found. The California Department of Health Care Services did finally cut funding to 16 rehab clinics earlier this month. It also announced that it will now closely review every rehab facility statewide.
The Department of Commerce released data today showing that the U.S. economy grew 1.7% in the second quarter of 2013. The Commerce Department says that between April and June of this year, the gross domestic product in the U.S. grew more than it did in the previous quarter, largely thanks to increased spending by businesses and decreased spending cuts by the federal government. The growth exceeds predictions made by economists who estimated just a 1% rise in GDP. Despite the evidence of growth exceeding expectations, 1.7% is still rather slow, showing a slow but steady economic recovery.
Two Libyan officials tied to the regime of deposed leader Muammar Gaddafi have been sentenced to death this week. Former Education Minister Ahmed Ibrahim was convicted today of murder and inciting violence during the country's 2011 civil war. Ibrahim rallied citizens to take up arms and fight the rebels attempting to oust the former leader, according to the court. He was also found guilty of kidnapping and killing a man, as well as ordering others to kidnap and kill five additional people. Ibrahim was also convicted of spreading false information and of terrorizing and demoralizing the public. The sentencing comes just days after top security chief Mansour al-Dawlah Gaddafi, a relative of the former leader, was condemned to death for his role in the civil war. Al-Dawlah Gaddafi held a leadership position in the Popular Guard, one of Libya's most maligned security bodies. Both sentences were handed down by a criminal court in the western city of Misrata. According to Libyan law, the men are to be executed by firing squad. The cases now move to the Libyan Supreme Court, where they will either be accepted or appealed.
British national Shaker Amer told his lawyer that Guantanamo Bay prison guards search him and his cell on a daily basis and sometimes sexually assault him during their search. Amer has been held in the prison for nearly 11 years without being charged with a crime and has been on hunger strike over prison conditions, along with many other inmates, since January. According to Amer, this sort of abuse is widespread at the prison. Detainees have been passively resisting guards at Guantanamo for months, and Amer has repeatedly refused to leave the recreation yard peaceably, causing the guards to crack down on him and other resisting prisoners.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a U.N. spokeswoman in Afghanistan said today that civilian deaths have spiked about 23% in the first half of this year. It's believed that the upcoming drawdown has emboldened insurgents, causing more attacks on military and civilian targets. This is the first time a detailed report of the causes of civilian deaths has been released. A report says almost 75% of civilian deaths are caused by insurgents, specifically the Taliban. The International Security Assistance Force issued a statement in response to the growing number of civilian deaths, blaming the carnage on the indiscriminate use of improvised explosive devices. The ISAF said that continued use of IEDs proves that the Taliban is not serious about protecting Afghan civilians.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. Israeli armed settlers attack Palestinian villagers and Israeli troops conduct a military training on Palestinian farmlands. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli settlers attacked on Wednesday Palestinian residents of Asira al-Kibliya village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Witnesses said that armed settlers attacked a construction site at the edge of the village and tried to set it on fire when residents rushed to the scene and forced them out. Villagers say that settlers' attacks targeting their homes and farmlands are escalating in the past few weeks. Also in northern West Bank, Israeli troops invaded the village of Beita near Nablus and searched and ransacked a number of homes. Local youth clashed with the invading forces with stones, while troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at them. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, local sources reported. Later, troops moved out of Beita and erected a roadblock near the village entrance, then searched residents' cars and inspected their ID cards. Later on Wednesday afternoon, Israeli army forces conducted a military training using live gunfire near the village of Ya'bud in Jenin district in northern West Bank. Residents said that army helicopters were used in the training as troops erected a roadblock near the village and stopped cars from leaving or entering it. Earlier on Wednesday morning, the Israeli Army Navy conducted a training off the coast of Jaffa City. Israeli sources announced that live ammunition were also used. The sources did not say when the training will end. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, July 31st news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan White and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Aaron J. Bernard, Casey Decker, Robin Ryan, and Jemai Cherry. The producer is Ben Renner. Special thanks to reporters at the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Kurt Lauer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 91.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Stay tuned for Occupy Radio starting at 6 p.m., Hard Knock Radio at 7 p.m., Drinking from Puddles at 8 p.m., Life During Wartime at 10 p.m., and Table for One at midnight. Tomorrow on Voices from the Edge at 8 p.m., host Joanne Hardesty will interview Helen Gilbert on the Free Marissa Now mobilization campaign. At 9, you'll hear Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. And at 9:30 on Fight the Empire, there will be an interview with Chris Nedler on Peak Oil. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. In Boston, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, senators question Obama administration officials on government spying programs as new information on the secret surveillance court comes out. The sentencing phase of the Bradley Manning court-martial gets underway. In Mexico, indigenous communities fight a foreign investor's plan to reopen a controversial gold mine. And we'll go to Myanmar to look at how civil society is developing after decades of military rule. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Voters are going to the polls today in Zimbabwe in the first national election since 2008, when violence triggered a political crisis in the southern African country. The presidential election once again pits longtime ruler Robert Mugabe against Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. Voting irregularities are already emerging. FSRN's Gary Kaichanza reports.
Hundreds of voters were turned away after finding their names were left off the voter rolls. Most of the affected registered during the extended voter registration period. The aspiring voters were denied access to the polls, even though they were carrying voter registration papers bearing their identity numbers in their assigned polling locations. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has been running notices on radio and newspapers saying workers would accept the registration papers at the polls. FSRN visited a number of polling stations in Harare and witnessed several people being turned away. MDCT Party National Organizing Secretary Nelson Chamisa told reporters the voter roll problem is a cause for concern.
So those are issues we are raising with ZEC, and we've actually deployed our team to raise those issues with ZEC, hoping that they will be rectified.
Election Commission Chair Rita Makarao says that they have corrected the problem and ordered polling officers throughout the country to allow the affected to vote in any polling station. Vote counts begin this evening. Yesterday, Robert Mugabe said he would step aside if polls favored Morgan Tsvangirai. The government has deployed security forces in several areas to stem any potential violence. Garika Ichaunza, FSRN, Harare.
The number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan is up 23% in the first half of this year. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan finds nearly 4,000 civilians have died. UN Radio's Jerry Adams has more on the latest report.
It said the main factors driving the spike were the increased use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, by anti-government elements, particularly in areas populated or frequented by civilians. The report also noted increased civilian casualties due to targeted killings and attacks against civilian government workers, as well as fighting between Afghan armed forces and anti-government elements, and high-level threats and intimidation.
Deaths of women and children rose 38% in that same time period. Supporters of human rights attorney Lynn Stewart rallied in New York City today in support of her bid for compassionate release from federal prison. Stewart is serving a 10-year sentence stemming from her defense of Omar Abdel Rahman. She was convicted of providing material support to terrorists for passing messages on her client's behalf. Stewart is currently suffering from breast cancer. Her previous release request had been turned down, but now her lawyer says the judge will reconsider because Stewart has less than 18 months to live. The hearing is scheduled for this afternoon. In other news from New York, coastal communities who were impacted when Superstorm Sandy struck last autumn converged on Lower Manhattan today, demanding a refocusing of recovery efforts. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
Many who rallied Wednesday afternoon lost their homes or jobs to the storm. They say disaster dollars have been slow to arrive, and federal and local governments aren't doing enough. And Maya Gelman is policy director for the Alliance for a Just Rebuilding, a coalition of labor, community, and environmental groups. She says Sandy compounded already existing housing and employment crises that she hopes recovery efforts will address.
There will be billions and billions of dollars invested in the city and the recovery. The federal money will probably be something around $15 billion, and the city anticipated more than $20 billion in its strategic initiative for recovery and resilience. And it's really critical that that money not go to rebuilding the same conditions that existed before the storm.
Demonstrators' demands include affordable housing and the sustainable rebuilding of infrastructure destroyed by the storm. As the New York mayoral race intensifies, storm victims want the next mayor to heed their calls for a just reconstruction. Peter Rue, FSRN, New York.
And finally, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans says law enforcement does not need to obtain a warrant to access location data from cell phones. Two of the court's three judges ruled Tuesday this information belongs to the phone company and not the phone user, and therefore police don't have to prove probable cause of a crime to track someone. The ACLU, which is litigating the case, argues this legal justification is flawed because it was established before the widespread use of electronic communications. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Boston. New revelations about the breadth of the National Security Agency's mass spying programs came to light today. In addition to collecting data about Americans' phone records, the NSA collects information from emails and web searches without individual warrants. Senators convened this morning to question government officials about these spying programs and demanded more transparency and more oversight. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Just hours before facing the Senate Judiciary Committee, officials from the Office of National Intelligence released the secret court order that authorized the collection of millions of individual phone records from Verizon. The document, which was originally going to be kept classified until 2038, has large sections blacked out and redacted, but confirms that the government has been storing, quote, all call data records for communications between the United States and abroad or wholly within the United States. FBI Deputy Director Sean Joyce defended this program Wednesday, along with many others conducted under the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, by saying they have kept the country safe by helping federal agents foil terror plots.
And I think we need to frame this by understanding who the adversary is and what they're trying to do. And they're trying to harm America. They're trying to strike America. And what we need is we need all these tools.
Several lawmakers were not satisfied by this justification. Vermont Democrat and committee chair Patrick Leahy said the executive branch shouldn't have the sole authority to determine the balance between national security and privacy.
We could have more security if we strip search everybody who came into every building in America. We're not going to do that. We have more security if we closed our borders completely to everybody. We're not going to do that. If we put a wiretap on everybody's cell phone in America, if we search everybody's home. But there are certain things, certain areas of our own privacy that we Americans expect. And at some point, you have to know where the balance is.
Leahy also raised concerns about a top-secret government surveillance program called X-KeyScore, which was revealed Wednesday in documents leaked by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden and published by The Guardian. Using X-KeyScore, analysts at the National Security Agency and the private companies it hired could comb through the databases of the emails, Facebook chats, web searches, and browsing histories of millions of individuals. One document says the program gives the government access to, quote, nearly everything a typical user does on the internet. No warrant, court order, or official NSA approval is necessary for such a search. Several lawmakers on the committee, including Minnesota Democrat Al Franken, said the existence of X-KeyScore and other recently revealed programs should not have been kept secret. He said it's, quote, bad for privacy and bad for democracy when the government only makes information public in response to a leak by a whistleblower.
I don't want a situation where the government is transparent only when it's convenient for the government. When it's ad hoc transparency, that doesn't engender trust, I don't think.
Franken says he'll introduce a bill this week to force the government to disclose how many Americans have had their information collected under FISA and allow private companies to disclose how many government orders for private user data they have received. The Yahoo Corporation asked the government for permission to reveal this information earlier this month, and the government announced this week that it will begin a multi-month process to determine whether or not they can declassify it. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, the sentencing phase of the trial against Army Private Bradley Manning began at Fort Meade. Manning was convicted Tuesday of 20 of the 22 charges he faced, including charges under the Espionage Act. For more on the details of the convictions and what's next, we're joined by Elizabeth Goitin, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks very much.
Military Judge Lynn said that Manning faces up to 136 years in prison on the 20 charges. What do government prosecutors need to prove in this phase of the sentencing?
Well, things get a little tougher for them now because the factors that are relevant at the sentencing hearing are some of the factors that were considered by the judge not to be relevant at the guilt phase, including Bradley Manning's motive and whether or not his disclosures cause serious harm. And these issues are issues that actually are not as easy for the government as some of the issues about whether or not Bradley Manning actually accessed and disclosed these documents. So it's going to be a tougher road for them to hoe, I think.
So his motivations and also whether or not the leaks caused harm. Manning was acquitted of the aiding the enemy charge. Government prosecutors claimed in that charge that he had knowingly given intelligence to the enemy through WikiLeaks. That was not proven. Does that acquittal change how the sentencing will take place or what the burden of proof will be?
Well, that's interesting. It really doesn't in theory, because in theory, the sentencing hearing will only address, you know, the harm and the motive on those particular charges for which he was acquitted. But certainly the fact that, that the government did not produce, despite its best efforts, any evidence that Manning knew that Al-Qaeda would be seeing and accessing this information, that right there does say something about what the government will be able to prove about his motive.
Now, to go to that question of harm and to provide some context about some of the information that Manning leaked, he disclosed hundreds of thousands of documents. They included a video of a 2007 helicopter attack that shows U.S. soldiers firing on unarmed civilians and children in Baghdad. There were incident reports in Afghanistan that revealed a U.S.-run assassination squad. Then there were the diplomatic cables that showed the U.S. spied on U.N. officials, that the FBI trained Egypt's security forces that then committed torture, and that the administrations of both Bush and Obama thwarted international attempts to investigate torture. Much of these details were not known before the leak. What is in this information that the government is pointing to that would put U.S. national security at risk?
That's a good question. There were original classification authorities who testified at the hearing and spoke about their decisions or the reasons why the information was classified and why it could harm national security. You know, risk to national security is often very much in the eye of the beholder. It's often a subjective judgment. It's not hard to imagine national security consequences to almost anything if you get creative enough.
Manning was found guilty of five Espionage Act offenses. The Center for Constitutional Rights has called that act a discredited relic of the World War I era, created as a tool to suppress political dissent and anti-war activism. How could this conviction affect cases brought against other people who leak information, such as Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor who revealed extensive surveillance of Americans or others?
Well, unfortunately, this discredited relic appears to be enjoying a bit of a renaissance. It's being used far more commonly than it's ever been used before in cases involving disclosures of classified information to the media. So these convictions, if they stand on appeal, will set a precedent for the next, make it easier to bring the next Espionage Act case against a national security leaker, even if that leaker is a whistleblower and is simply bringing to light government misconduct that never should have been classified in the first place.
Elizabeth Goitein is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. She joined us to discuss the sentencing phase for Army Private Bradley Manning, which began today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Foreign investment in Mexico's mining sector has expanded dramatically over the past decade, and it's raising tensions in some local communities. The most contentious conflicts have arisen in indigenous communities, where residents say the government failed to inform and consult local populations before handing out 50-year mining permits to foreign investors. In Oaxaca, one permit would reopen a mine which local communities fought to close down. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
Calpulalpan de Mendez is a picturesque mountain community. It's the only village in the state of Oaxaca with the special designation of Magic Town, a title given by the federal government to promote tourism. Calpulalpan also has a history of silver and gold mining going back more than two centuries. But now town residents are in a determined fight against foreign mining interests. Salvador Aquino is a member of Calpulalpan's Council of Elders, an important advisory body within the local indigenous governance system.
Precisely because of our experience of knowing what it means to be a miner, what mining work entails, and what the consequences mean in terms of water pollution, of the devastation of aquifers, of the destruction of forests, and of contamination of communal land. The legacy of these 200 years of experience led the community and the Council of Elders to the conclusion that it was no longer possible to continue with the exploitation of minerals, considering the experience left us with devastation in terms of lives and communal territory.
When Aquino was young, his father worked in the nearby Natividad mine and died of silicosis, an occupational lung disease. Aquino says decades ago, Calpulalpan was known informally as the widow's town due to the high death rate for miners. Another resident with 14 years' experience in the Natividad mine is Fernando Felix Mendez. He says workers were given helmets, lamps, and gloves, but no masks or respirators.
That's why all of us who have worked inside the mine have lung problems, because part of the job involves working with machines, which use air pressure and are heavily greased so as not